it's a 1 degree shift, no different than all the other shifts that came before it, but suddenly you get this different outcome. And a lot of the time, the process of building better habits is like that. You're accumulating these little 1% changes day in and day out. You don't really see anything. You don't feel anything at first. And then suddenly you get to this phase transition where everything starts happening a little bit easier. And I like to refer to that period there as kind of the plateau of latent potential. There's sort of this like gap there between your effort and your outcomes. And you need something to be able to get you through that plateau, because you're not really complaining about working for like 3 or 6 months or a year and not getting the results you want is sort of like complaining about heating an ice cube from like 25 to 31 degrees and it not melting yet. Like the work was not wasted. It's just being stored. And so you just need to continue to work until you can release all of that potential that you've been building up.
This is the podcast for people that believe they do not need to change the world. We believe it's all about becoming the most effective version of yourself in the moments in life that matter the most. This is
the Inner Changemaker Podcast. Instead of changing the world, change their world.
Changemakers, what is going on, everyone? It is your man, your host, Jay Wong, and I appreciate you joining me for another interview on The Inner Changemaker. So excited to be back doing these interviews and sharing these gems, these patterns, and this week is no different. So let me ask you a couple questions. Have you ever struggled in building the right habits to allow yourself to be successful? Have you ever set goals or New Year's resolutions and you had the best of intentions, whether it was going to the gym or whether it was eating less or eating more or whether it was growing your business? You had the best of intentions in hitting these goals and yet you still failed? I'm gonna give you a couple seconds. I know for me, I've been there many of times. And one of the patterns that has come up in a lot of the interviews on this show is that successful people don't just want success, right? Like, who wants success? Of course, everybody, right? Everybody that's watching this wants to be more successful. They want to be more in tune with who they are and they wanna be able to step into that at will. Of course, we know that. That's the basics. But we notice that successful people, people that have been featured on this podcast and on this show, they expect to be successful. And that's the difference. They actually build it in to their habits, to their rituals. And so Vince Lombardi once said, excellence is a habit. So they expect those things. And we typically get what we expect. So that's what this interview is all about. It's all about how to build the habits, the small little changes that's gonna help us create the biggest difference. And we have James Clear, the American author, the guy behind jamesclear.com. He's been a photographer in 30 countries. But on top of that, he has millions of blog readers every single week when he posts his blog posts. And he has been diving into this over the last couple years because his blog always is answering the question of how can we live better. And he's been writing about habits, he's been writing about human potential, and he's literally put the system and the framework into Atomic Habits. And so that's what this book is all about. And that's what this interview is all about. And there is something here for everybody, whether you're looking to grow your content channel, and he shares his story of not just how he got started, but how he grew from zero readers to now over millions of readers every single time he posts. And we talk about the system that he has instilled. And I got a chance to dive into an early copy of this, and it's been amazing to actually put this system into play into my life. And I know you're gonna get so much out of it to hear how to think about creating the right systems. And we all know half the battle is about mindset, the other half is the execution of it. So I hope you get some great value out of this interview, and I won't hold you back any further. So without any more delays, here is the interview of my man, James Clear.
Mr. James Clear, welcome to the show, brother.
Hey, thank you so much. It's great to be talking with you.
Yeah, I'm really excited to actually get a chance to dive into this. I know we're here to talk about your new book, Atomic Habits. And there's so many things about the book that I actually like? And you know, there's so many different ways that I wanted to approach this, but I know you mentioned this idea from the book where, I don't want to ruin it, but you know, there's a lot of things, there's this concept in the book that you're saying that when people kind of hit this point, that sometimes they are known as like an overnight success. And I think sometimes when people come on to the show, that's certainly not the case. And I know for you, when you started, you know, writing your blog, you know, you had X amount of, you know, thousands of subscribers a couple years in. Now you have over millions of readers. I mean, how does it feel for you knowing that there's so many people, you know, resonating with your writing and reading your blog so consistently?
Well, I mean, it's awesome. I feel very lucky. Fortunate to be able to share the ideas and the work with so many people. It's cool to get feedback from folks and hear about, you know, when I write articles, a lot of the time most of them are written as like a message to myself. It doesn't seem like that. It sounds right. Like I'm just writing an article and sharing it with folks, but most of the time I'm trying to remind myself to stay on track. But I tend to write about like broader principles and then give examples of how they apply to various areas of life, like how this principle of habits could apply to building better strength training habits in the gym or photography habits or meditation habit or whatever. And it's very cool to be able to see once an idea is shared, get emails back from people on how it applies to their life. And you'll get people. It's interesting for me to see people from wildly different places be like, I feel like you wrote this just for me, which to me makes me feel like we share a lot more in common than we realize. That people's problems and the specific details of your problem are based on the circumstances of your life, but the underlying principles and the fundamentals of problems that humans face are very universal. And so that's kind of given me a cool window into that. And otherwise, I just feel grateful to be able to share it with folks. And then also, I try to treat my ideas like a scientist, which is that when a scientist gets new evidence, they update their beliefs. And so I share an article and it's polished. I try to make it highly edited and like well thought out, but it's really a first draft, because once I get feedback back from people and they say, oh, did you look at this book, or have you missed this part of research, or have you thought about this angle? That's great, because for me that like stress tests the ideas and forces me to upgrade and improve it the next time. So I'm kind of endlessly tweaking, and the audience is a big part of that.
For sure. I mean, that feedback, I mean, that's what a lot of, you know, first-time creators, they're missing, right? And so I'm kind of curious for you, how intentional, like when you started writing, I mean, now, you know, you're coming out with your very first book, right? And, you know, we're just talking a little offline about, you know, the tour and everything that you have lined up. How intentional was it, like when you got into, you know, consistently publishing on your blog, that you were like, was that always the idea of like, oh, I'm going to be this writer and I'm going to, you know, have, right? Like I'm going to grow this audience through this blog.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. For my particular case, it was much more haphazard than that. And I'm a fairly, like, I think I lean towards being like a planner. You know, I'm someone who for a long time I would set goals for all kinds of things, you know, like the weights I wanted to lift in the gym or the grades I wanted to get in school or the revenue numbers I wanted to hit in my business. And I've gradually shifted from that goals first philosophy. And this is one of the core themes of Atomic Habits, is that we do not rise to the level of our goals. We fall to the level of our systems. And so the progress that we make, I mean, goals are not useless. They're good for setting a direction, but whether or not you make progress is highly dependent on the system and the habits that you follow each day. So in my particular case, for the evolution of me as a writer, I didn't start with the intention to become a writer. In fact, if you were to talk to some of my, like my high school teachers, my college professors, I don't think any of them would have said, yeah, he's a great writer. They'd probably just be like, yeah, he's average, like whatever. I only took one English class in college. Like writing was not a major part of my academic career.
Did it come easy to you though? Or
being curious comes easy to me. And I think that's a huge part of it. So I would say my disposition is to be a learner, to be curious, to ask questions, to kind of like dig into topics. And I was always applying that more to the sciences as a student. I studied chemistry and physics mostly in undergrad. But eventually I started shifting a little bit more to social sciences, psychology, performance, and some of the topics that I write about now. Mm-hmm. And I like to refer to myself as idea agnostic. And what I mean is that I don't care where good ideas come from. Like if it's biology or neuroscience or chemistry or philosophy, it doesn't matter to me as long as it's a good idea. And so I, in that sense, what I write about is good for me because it gives me a very wide range of things to investigate. And so I can always stay interested because there's, you know, I can just write about whatever I want. And the lens of human behavior and habits is very broad. And so I'm able to kind of narrow in on different aspects of that picture as I find interesting. But yeah, I don't want to say I stumbled into the career, but I knew that I needed to build an audience to have a business. And I knew that writing and building an email list was a good way to do that. And so I started to do it. And then I wrote about a variety of other things before I launched jamesclear.com and wrote about some other topics. And none of them kind of clicked. And then when I started writing about habits, things just took off. Like it was that jamesclear.com took off much faster than any other site that I had created. And the topics there, just for whatever reason, I think I both because I was interested in them and just because it's a relevant topic to everybody's lives, they took off better. And then once the feedback was more positive, I had every reason in the world to continue writing about it. And so it was kind of a gradual evolution in that way.
And a lot of times there, I mean, you've written about so many things, right? From like intermittent fasting to lifting weights to, you know, mental health to goal setting to habits, right? And as I look through like your article list, I mean, I could see, you know, different points of that. And I could see, obviously, you know, in reading the book, there's some of the, you know, concepts that you refer back to. What were some of the like sites that you tried beforehand, like before jamesclear.com essentially became the vehicle for you?
Yeah, I was just telling someone the other day, I feel like the trend of my career has gradually been up and to the right. But at any point, if you would have caught me, the arrow is pointing in a, like a wildly different direction, you know, like depending on where I'm at and what I'm interested in and whatever. So but gradually things keep continue to move and improve. So I've been an entrepreneur for 8 years. JamesClear.com will be 6 years old in November. So the first two years were kind of that period where I was experimenting with different ideas and trying things out. Now I refer to it as the period where I incubated my skill set. But basically the idea is I had no idea what I was doing early on. And so I had to just try a variety of things and also teach myself new skills. Like there are, this is true for pretty much any entrepreneur. There's like a startup cost to the beginning of a project because there are all these like one-time things that you have to do that you don't need to do again. Like I had to teach myself how to code. So suddenly I'm like a web designer. I'm not actually a web designer, but I had to learn how to do a serviceable job at that so that I could have a site.
Yeah.
And then I had to learn what is an email list and how you set that up. And then, you know, how to write a good copy for email pop-up forms or for, you know, a blog post title or whatever. So now I'm a copywriter, even though I'm not actually that, but I have to be for the business.
Right.
And entrepreneurship kind of forces you into all these little nooks and crannies that you're not that thing, but you need to be at least to a serviceable degree to have your business. So there was a lot of that going on for me in the first 2 years. A good piece of advice I got early on was to try things until something comes easily. And so I kind of explored broadly in the beginning. And then once I found something, in this case, habits, that was a topic that went well, then I decided to focus on that more. And I didn't know this at the time, but that strategy is actually called the explore-exploit trade-off. And it applies to a lot of different areas of life. So if you think about building a career, the idea is early on, you should explore broadly and try a variety of different options, business ideas, careers, you know, whatever it happens to be for your particular for the particular path you want to walk, roles and positions within the same company. And then after you have that period of exploration, maybe it's 3 years, maybe it's five, maybe it's 10, you still have a long timeline for the rest of your career. And so then you should start to exploit whatever the best option is that you found so far. And the same kind of principle can be applied on a smaller time scale, which is if you're working on like a project, and you're trying to figure out the best way to do it. Early on, you should explore and try a variety of different ways of getting the work done. But as you get closer to the deadline, you're running out of time. And so now you need to exploit and just implement the best solution that you have so far and get some results. So the timeline has something to do with it. And also the other thing to pay attention to is whether you're winning or losing in that moment. The more that you're losing, the more you should explore more and try to find some other solutions. The more that you're winning, the more you should exploit the best solution that you've found so far. So anyway, I kind of, without knowing it, I started to employ some of that strategy early on. And I explored broadly and tried some website ideas. Like I had one site. My very first idea was creating an iPhone app, which was bigger at the time than it is now. I mean, iPhone apps are still quite popular, but it was sure. it was like a hot new way to build a business then. So I think I spent $1,700 getting that app designed, and or $1,600. And to this day, it has made like $17 or $19. So that didn't work out as well. So that's not
as good as a return as you thought initially.
Yes. Yeah. That's not a good way. I'm not good at math, but that's not a good way to work.
Yeah.
So that was the first idea. Second idea, I had a couple different websites, but one of the more interesting ones was my girlfriend at the time, like many people, loved puppies. And so I was like, well, maybe I bought the domain puppypresent.com. And I thought, well, what if you could partner with breeders who have all these puppies and then rent out like an hour with them to play with a puppy as like a present? So like for their birthday, it's like, hey, I'll give you, you know, right. 30 bucks and we'll go play with these puppies for an hour or whatever. So I thought it was a smart idea. It was like a marketplace for puppy time. And I think customers would love it. But as I started calling breeders, they hated the idea because they were like, wait, you mean you're going to come play with these dogs, but you're not going to buy one? And I was like, yes, exactly. And they're like, no, I don't want anything to do with this. So anyway, that was that one slid through the cracks. And then I had a site about small business marketing. And that one I built up to about 20,000 email subscribers. That was kind of my first little success where I like at least learned. When I started jamesco.com, I started from zero. But because of that previous site, I at least knew what to do. You know, like I knew that I could at least get a site to 20,000 subscribers. So that meant, well, if I can get to 20, then I could probably get to 50 right. or something like that. So it at least gave me like a roadmap to follow, even though the topic was different.
You know, that is so interesting because I feel like many people come up with that almost like a rent a pet or, you know, like the hourly pet idea. And it's you know, there's so, and it sounds so good, but you know, not a lot of people that really...
Somebody will probably figure it out. I don't know. It'll probably happen at some point, but yeah, anyway.
So, I mean, you went through, you grew the site. I mean, you went through all the different types of businesses, and I think it's so important for a lot of first time creators and first time entrepreneurs, like to actually, you know, I wrote it down here, explore and exploit. Right. Mm. This idea of, you know, figuring out where you could win in and what, you know, what is actually going to, you know, help you in the case of, you know, building, you know, your skill set and, you know, your vision for what you want to be able to create.
It's important to do, especially early on. It's important because you don't know what's going to work for your particular business. I remember when I was getting started, I read this article and it was like 50 ways to drive traffic to your website.
Okay.
And so over the next couple months, I went through all 50 ways. I tried them all and none of them really worked for me. And I was like, what is going on here? Like, am I doing it wrong? Like what, you know? And eventually I just kept trying some other things as well. And I found two or three that did work. And so the conclusion I came to was not that the site was just terrible advice or that article was terrible advice, but that advice is very contextual. And so it depends on your particular circumstance. Like I have a friend who, she runs a calligraphy business. So it's all like hand lettering and prints and stuff. Instagram is huge for her. It's a very visual business. She's right. making prints. Instagram is even better for her than her email list is. That's basically, Instagram is basically where she gets all of her clients. Mm. For me, Instagram is not super relevant. It's not irrelevant, but it doesn't right. move the needle anywhere close to what email or something else would. So, I think it's important to realize that different people are dealing with different businesses require different marketing channels. And so just because someone recommends something doesn't mean it's a good fit for you, and you need to be willing to explore and then exploit the one that fits you best.
Mm. I think that's such a really, it's an important distinction because I think people hear all sorts of different advice, right? And they're looking to figure out, you know, what actually works for them. And the best way of figuring that out is actually implementing those things and just seeing and getting that level of feedback. And
things also change quickly. You know, I mean, the sources of traffic for my website are very different this year than they were 2 or 3 years ago. So you have to be, even once you find something that works, you need to be willing to explore a little bit every now and then, like maybe say 80-20 or 90-10.
Sure.
So that you can stay up to date and, you know, and see what else is coming down the pipeline. And when things fade away, you have something else to take their place.
So for your blog, I do want us to, you know, dive deeper within, you know, creating the habits. So I'm almost selfishly asking this, but from you mentioned like your traffic source, right? How has that evolved over the span? Like, what were you focusing on in 2012, 2013 when you started the blog versus, you know, what you're doing in the last couple of years?
Well, I generally like to build to divide the process of building a site into three categories. So the first category is content, and that's the most important one, but also the least sexy one. For me, I wrote a new article every Monday and Thursday, so two a week for the first 3 years. And that was really the habit, the writing habit that like set the business on a different trajectory. And I don't think it has to be twice a week, but the point of creating high quality content and showing up consistently, I mean, that's a really big part of the process for any business that's similar to mine, whether it's writing or podcasting or YouTube videos or whatever. Sure. So that's the first bucket.
And just doing that, right?
And people don't like the answer because it's not an interesting technical strategy or a tactic,
right?
But the analogy I like to use, imagine like weightlifting, you know, so people want to get in shape and they do all kinds of things. They buy running shoes or knee sleeves or, protein powders, and all of that stuff makes like the last 5% of difference at most. The thing that makes the real difference is, are you getting your workouts in and not missing, you know, like if you could do all the workouts and all the reps, but not have the protein powder in the knee sleeves, would you still get in shape? Yeah, probably. If you only had the protein powder in the knee sleeves, but didn't do any of the workouts, it wouldn't do anything.
Yeah.
So it's very contingent on, there's kind of that fundamental that makes like the 90, 95% of the difference. And I think that that's true for writing and content creation as well, that it's really about, you know, it's like, okay, you want a bigger site. Well, write two articles a week for 2 years and then get back to me. You know, right. It's like that. That's kind of the
With that, and like, don't even focus on. You're absolutely right, because it's kind of like the, you know, it's like the hinge that swings, you know, the bigger door, right? The small hinge.
So that's the first bucket. I think it's the most important, but it's also the least sexy. The second one is design and conversion, and so for that, you know, it depends on the site, but for me, I think some principles that apply to different things are. One, you should only have a single call to action for each page. So basically have a single goal. Make it very clear to the reader and to the visitor what you want them to do next. You know, it's not their job to figure out what's important on the page. It's your job to visually weight the most important thing, or to make it very clear and obvious what the most important thing is. And then there's also like a rule of thumb that I like to use for email, which doesn't apply to every business, but I think is a good starting point, which is that you take total new subscribers to your email list from the last month over total new traffic. And that percentage, if you're at 2% or above, then your conversion is good enough and your bottleneck is you need more traffic. If you're below 2%, then you need to fix the conversion before you worry about driving more people, because you got kind of too many people falling through the cracks. So using that 2% rule is kind of like a general guideline, I think, is a good one. Again, it varies by the business. Like my personal one, we shoot for 3%, but that has changed as traffic has changed. So right. when I had less traffic, you know, 100,000 or 500,000 visitors a month, I could get like 4 or 5% conversion. But once you get up over and get into the millions, then, you know, it's hard. Like some months now, if we get 2.7 or 2.8, then that's good. So it just kind of depends there. But so that's the second bucket, is design. And then the third bucket is traffic. And, you know, that can come from a variety of areas, social, search, things like that. My business tends to not, for whatever reason, not be that heavy social. So I have friends who they'll get 40% of their traffic from Facebook or something. But it doesn't work that way for me. You know, we get like 20% from social in total. And then Facebook is the largest like chunk of that. And then the third category of traffic is partnerships. So things like Time or Entrepreneur Magazine or Fast Company or Forbes or whatever. So working with companies like that has helped drive a fair number of conversions as well. And again, traffic sources are going to be dependent on your circumstances. But I think if you try to master those three buckets, you'll be in good shape.
Yeah. I mean, that's probably a different category and a different, you know, mini book in itself. But you said something there that I know you touch on in the book, which I thought was really interesting. You know, you said for the first 3 years you wrote every Monday, or you published an article every Monday and Thursday, and you just kept at that. And I know in the book you talk so much about, you know, identity being a huge catalyst in actually changing your habits. How much of those 3 years, like, did that kind of enforce the identity of like being a writer and being this blogger with these people with you, if you didn't come with that intention initially when you kind of started the whole site?
I think it's a good question. So this is one reason why I feel habits are so important. It's true that habits can deliver results. They can help you be more productive or to lose weight or to reduce stress or make more money.
Yeah.
And that's all true. And those are all great things that habits can provide. But the real reason that habits matter so much is that they help inform your sense of self. They help provide evidence of your desired identity. So they like give you a reason to believe something about yourself. So in this example, what you're really saying is, yeah, by writing every Monday and Thursday, I was embodying the identity of what it meant to be a writer. And the same thing is true for pretty much any habit. Whenever you make your bed, you embody the identity of someone who is clean and organized. Whenever you study for 20 minutes, you embody the identity of someone who is studious. Whenever you go to the gym, you embody the identity of someone who is fit. And so your habits are really the way that you provide evidence to yourself that this is who I am. And I think this is actually more powerful than sometimes people will say things like fake it till you make it or something like that.
Sure.
But fake it till you make it is asking you to believe something that you don't have evidence for. It's saying, you know, but you should just tell yourself that you're this thing.
Right.
But habits provide evidence that you are that kind of person. It's almost like every action you take is a vote for the type of person that you want to become. And as you start casting votes, you build up and accumulate this evidence for who you are. And the more votes that you cast and the larger that pile of evidence becomes, the greater the reason you have to believe that about yourself. And that's a very empowering place to be, because once you adopt an identity, you know, it's like it's one thing to say I want this, but it's something very different to say I am this. And once you believe that, you're not even really pursuing behavior change anymore. You're just acting in alignment with the type of person that you already believe that you are. And so I think the most effective way to do that, to upgrade and expand your identity, to develop this new sense of self-image, to become confident in yourself in a certain area of life, is to focus on small habits that cast a vote for that identity. And as you continue to repeat that habit, you build up evidence of it and you start to believe it about yourself.
And I guess I imagine writing all the different blogs around health and weightlifting and just different aspects of your life, you have to kind of figure out these habits to be successful in each and everything. And it's not just applicable to one area, but it was, I guess you found it to be applicable to all areas. Was that part of the reason why you wanted to release a book completely on habits? Was that part of the why?
I think that, so if you think more broadly about how do we get great results in life, how do we get great outcomes, whether it's in business or your personal life, I think it's a combination of two things. So the first are your decisions, and your decisions set the trajectory or the potential that is available to you. So say that you want to start a business.
Yeah.
You could decide to open like a local pizza parlor. Or you could say you have an idea to start like an email marketing company or software company or something like that. Either one, you're going to be working hard on either one. Entrepreneurship is tough either way. But the initial decision determines the potential or the trajectory that is possible for you. That, like, if you mapped out the line of where you could go. One business, the software business, the tech business, probably has a greater like hockey stick curve. It has more opportunity to scale.
Yeah.
So the trajectories look different. And that's determined by the initial decision. But how far you walk along that potential path is determined by your habits. And so you could start the pizza parlor, and if you had really killer habits, you could end up with an even better business than someone who had a good idea for a tech company but didn't have the habits to execute on it. And of course, what we really want is to make great decisions and to have great habits. And so one of the reasons that I wrote the book is because I also write about decision making every now and then, but I thought habits were a great place to start. Because you're already building them anyway. Like everyone has habits, and whether or not you, in a sense, your habits are like the method that you use to solve the problems you face throughout life. So like you say, for example, you you get home from work each day and you're feeling a little bit exhausted and tired. Yeah. And so one person might deal with that stress by going for a run for 10 minutes. Another person deals with that stress by playing video games for an hour. A third person deals with that stress by biting their nails or smoking a cigarette. And all of these things could become a habitual response to the problem that you face, which is you feel stressed and tired after work. But the original habit that you build is not necessarily the optimal habit for that particular circumstance. And once you realize that, you start to ask yourself this question, like, okay, well, can I design more optimal habits to deal with the problems that I face each day? Mm-hmm. And I think that those two things, that habits are the solutions to the recurring problems that we face, and you can design them so that they're more effective and more optimal. And habits are the path or the driver. They're the engine through which we walk the path set by our decisions and realize the potential that our decisions have available to them. Those two things are two of the core reasons why I wrote the book, because I feel like people need to have the ability to design better solutions to the problems they face and to realize the potential of the decisions that they make.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think, you know, in reading your book, I was telling you off record on this, that there's just so many different concepts in different areas that I love about it. One of them is that there's the four laws that you laid out there in terms of behavioral change, and you really just break down habits in a way that I think, you know, people could understand. But another one that I think is, you know, that you're highlighting on is, and I've seen you talk, or I've heard you talk about this, which is the idea of the 1%. Right? Mm-hmm. Of getting 1% better. Could you just expand a little bit on, I mean, how that even came into your awareness and how you kind of expand on it in Atomic Habits?
Well, getting 1% better each day is sort of that's the mantra that you need to take when it comes to building better habits. Yeah. And it's very easy to overlook the influence of any individual habit on a given day. And this is true both for positive habits and negative habits. You know, like you can... you could say something like what you choose to have for lunch today. You know, whether you choose to have a burger and fries or a salad, is very easy to overlook on any given day. It doesn't really, the scale doesn't really change at the end of the day. Your body doesn't really look any different in the mirror. You don't really see the impact. It's only 2 or 5 or 10 years later that the full impact of your habits are realized. And so it's kind of this like compounding process over time. And the hallmark of any compounding process is that the greatest returns are delayed. So you don't really see anything in the moment. One of the metaphors I like to use is kind of like the process of getting 1% better every day and building better habits is sort of like the process of melting an ice cube. So, you know, if you're in a cold room, it's 25 degrees or something, you can see your breath. You've got an ice cube sitting on the table, and then you heat it up, 26, 27, 28, 29. Nothing's happened. Still, there's an ice cube on the table, 30, 31. Yeah. And then you get to 32 degrees, and you have this phase transition. Suddenly, the ice cube melts. And it's a 1 degree shift, no different than all the other shifts that came before it, but suddenly you get this different outcome. And a lot of the time, the process of building better habits is like that. You're accumulating these little 1% changes day in and day out. You don't really see anything. You don't feel anything at first. And then suddenly you get to this phase transition where everything starts happening a little bit easier. And I like to refer to that period there as kind of the plateau of latent potential. There's sort of this like gap there between your effort and your outcomes. And you need something to be able to get you through that plateau, because you're not really complaining about working for like 3 or 6 months or a year and not getting the results you want is sort of like complaining about heating an ice cube from like 25 to 31 degrees and it not melting yet. Like the work was not wasted. It's just being stored. And so you just need to continue to work until you can release all of that potential that you've been building up.
Well, you know, I live in Canada, so I kind of resonate with the whole, you know, being hyper cold and trying to keep ourselves warm. One of my favorite lines from the book I literally copied and pasted and just had it here, is habits are the compound interests of self-improvement. Like, I was reading about myself, like, man, James Clear just dropped the mic through the book.
Well, the same way that, I mean, you know, the most common example of compound interest is finance, right? You're like, you're saving for retirement year in and year out. It doesn't really seem like a whole lot. And then you get to the last 10 years before retirement and you get this hockey stick growth and, you know, everything's compounding and growing real quickly. And habits are very similar in that way. Same way I just mentioned, like the weight example, where you eat something different, but the scale doesn't change, but you turn around 10 years later and you're like, I gained 60 pounds. Like, what happened? And the same way that money can multiply through compound interest, the effects of your habits multiply across time. So, in that way, habits are sort of like a double-edged sword. They can either work for you or against you. And time will feed, it will multiply whatever you feed it. Time is like this unit. And if you feed it a 1% improvement each day, then it will multiply that. And if you feed it a 1% decline each day, it will multiply that. And so good habits make time your ally. They allow it to work for you and compound with you. Bad habits make time your enemy. And so one of the keys of building, one of the reasons we need to understand how habits work and how to design them is so you can design them to your liking and sort of avoid the dangerous half of the blade with this double-edged sword. You can make sure that it's working for you rather than cutting you down.
Mm-hmm. So would it be fair to say that, on the podcast, we always, there's tons of, we have tons of listeners and people always asking, well, what's like the one, just give me like the one thing, right? Just give me like the one thing to focus on, the one, concept that I can implement today, right? Maybe someone's listening to this is like, okay, this sounds great. I totally buy into habits are, that's where I need to focus on. But what you're saying is really it's a combination of all the little things that you do.
Mm.
Right.
Well, so you can look at it in both ways. One of the reasons that I chose there were three reasons I chose the word atomic. So the first is that it has multiple meanings. The first is that the word atomic can mean like atom, so very tiny or small.
Right.
And I do think that habits should be small and easy to do. That's like a core piece of my philosophy.
Sure.
The second reason that I chose it is that the word atomic can mean the fundamental unit of a larger system. So atoms build into molecules, molecules build into compounds, and so on. And this gets to the point you're making right here, which is that it's not, I think I say this in the conclusion to Atomic Habits, the holy grail of habit change is not a single 1% improvement. It's 1,000 of them. It's all these little changes that are these fundamental units of a larger system that are all kind of layered together and organized towards this ultimate goal. It's kind of like each little change you make, each 1% improvement you make is like adding a grain of sand to one side of the scale, and eventually it starts to tip in your favor. So that's the second reason. The third reason, though, is that the word atomic can also mean the source of immense energy or power. So, and I think that kind of encapsulates the arc of the book, which is that if you make small and easy changes, 1% improvements, and you layer them on top of each other so that they're the fundamental units of a larger system, then eventually you can get some really incredible results, as the outcome. And so, in that way, it kind of like shows the full arc of my philosophy of like small habits, but not just a single habit, rather a collection or a system of them all organized towards the same goal and eventually leading to a remarkable result.
Yeah. Well, no, I think it's really important, I think, for all listeners and people that are watching this to understand that, because I know in even in the first couple of chapters of the book, you talk about what I thought was like what requires a bit of a mindset shift was, the idea of the difference of setting goals versus building an actual system, right? And it's funny because I think there's a lot of high performers. There's a lot of people that just understand how to achieve a thing, whether it's making money or getting good grades or, going on X amount of dates or whatever it is. People are good at that. But I love the distinction. I'd love for you to kind of share a little bit and expand on that in terms of the difference of not just necessarily achieving, but also having that in a system to create the repeated effects of that.
Well, if you think about it, whatever your current results are in life, whatever you're getting right now, your current system, your current habits are perfectly designed to deliver your current results. That's why you have them. And in a sense, your current results are just your results are like a lagging measure of your habits. Like if your weight is a lagging measure of your eating habits, your bank account is a lagging measure of your financial habits, the clutter in your office or in your room is a lagging measure of your cleaning habits. Like the results that you have are not, we focus on the results. We're a very results oriented society. And part of that is because, like news organizations or social media, they only talk about the result. They very rarely talk about the process behind the result. Like you're never going to see a news story that is something like, man eats chicken and salad for lunch today. That's never going to be the story. The story
huge
will be
headline.
6 months later when it's like, man lost 100 pounds. That's what you hear, but you never hear about the process. And so in a sense, you're kind of treating, if you make it all about the results, you're focusing or treating a symptom without treating the cause. And that's the kind of the core point behind focusing on systems over goals. Goals are all about the outcomes. They're all about the results. And systems are about the process behind those results. And so if you, the other thing to realize is that every goal is just a moment in time. So if you, the process of achieving a goal is just, it's a temporary change. It only changes your life for the moment. The process of changing a system changes your lifestyle going forward. You know, if you set a goal to have a clean room and you get some energy and a burst of motivation to clean it up, well, then you're like, you'll have a clean room right now. But if you don't change the sloppy habits behind what led to a messy room, then you're going to end up with a messy room again in like a month. So what you really need to do is not, we think the results need to change, but actually it's the system behind the results that need to change. And this again comes back to the importance of habits, because I think the way to change the system is by improving your habits. Your system, the systems of your life are essentially just the collection of repeated behaviors that you perform, which is to say they're the collection of habits that you form day in and day out. And eventually those habits lead to the results that you have. Mm.
No, it's and I think it's powerful. Like, it's really powerful. Like, and I read like your tagline. It's like, tiny changes, remarkable results. You know, and it's and that only happens over time, because we've all been there where we said, hey, we're gonna lose weight, or we're gonna go and clean our room, or we're gonna start working out, and because, you know, we just had a coffee, or because it's New Year's, or because, you know, we had this surge of willpower, right? Then we're able to do it in those moments. Maybe we can kind of almost force it in some ways. But then we naturally default, you know, to kind of like our, whatever our normal is. And so I'd love to hear your thoughts on how maybe you were able to kind of get out of that for yourself.
Yeah.
Like, as you were building these habits.
It's a good question. I think a metaphor I like to use, imagine you have like a garden hose, right? And the hose has a bend in the middle. If you want to increase the amount of water that's flowing through the hose, you have two options. The first option is you could just crank up the valve and force more water through.
Yeah.
And the second option is you could just remove the bend in the hose and let the water flow through naturally. And I think that sometimes, like when you have a cup of coffee or you feel motivated or it's right around New Year's or whatever, it's like you're forcing more water through the hose. It's like you're cranking up the valve. You're getting the willpower and motivation to overpower whatever the friction is that you happen to be facing in your life. And that can work, but the problem is it increases tension and it requires more energy and effort. Mm. Instead, I think it's much more useful to prime and design an environment that doesn't require as much willpower. You know, it's much more easy to stick to a good choice when you're being nudged in that direction anyway. So this is both the answer to your question, which is how did I go about doing this? And I think a broader principle that people can apply to their own life and work, which is that if you can restructure the environment to make the good habits easier and the bad habits harder, to remove the number of steps between you and the good choice and increase the number of steps between you and the bad choice, then suddenly having willpower becomes something that's much easier to do. So let me give you two examples. So the first example, personal habit, let's say something like, for a long time, I would brush my teeth twice a day, but I wouldn't floss consistently. Okay. So I looked at that behavior and I was like, well, why am I not doing this? Well, one thing was that the floss was inside a drawer in the bathroom, so I just wouldn't see it. I wouldn't think about it.
Right.
It wasn't obvious. The second thing was, it sounds silly, but I didn't really like the feeling of wrapping the floss around my fingers. It was just like uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. So I bought some of the pre-made flossers and I got a little bowl and I put the flossers in it and put it right next to my toothbrush. So now I brush my teeth, put the toothbrush down, pick a flosser up. It's obvious. It's easy. It's right there in front of me. Mm-hmm. And so just by changing the environment, that really honestly was all I had to do. Now I've been doing that twice a day for years. That was really the only change I had to make. It was just an environment issue. I wasn't remembering it. It wasn't easy enough.
Right. You gotta make it obvious, right?
Right, exactly. And these are two of the, you mentioned earlier, four laws of behavior change. Two of them are make it obvious and make it easy. And both of those were employed in this particular case.
Nice.
On the other side, you could use the same principle of environment design for breaking a bad habit. You know, like a lot of people feel like they play too many video games, they watch too much television or Netflix or something like that, watch too much screen time. So if you walk into pretty much any living room, where do all the couches and chairs face? They all face the television. So it's like, what is this room designed to get you to do? It's designed to get you to watch TV. So there are a variety of choices you could make here to reduce the odds that that would happen. You could take a chair and turn it away from the TV rather than next to it. You could take a remote control and put it inside a drawer instead of having it out and obvious on the coffee table or counter. You could take your television and put it inside like a wall unit with or cabinet doors so you don't see it as much. You could also increase the friction associated with the task. So you could take the batteries out of the remote control so that it takes like an extra 5 or 10 seconds to turn it on each time, which might be just enough time for you to be like, do I really want to watch this right now? Or am I just doing it mindlessly? You could unplug the TV after each use and then only plug it back in if you can say the name of the show that you want to watch. So you can't just like mindlessly turn on Netflix and find something.
Right. Has to be intentional.
Right. And if you really wanted to be extreme about it, I mean, you could take the TV off the wall and like put it in the closet and only take it out when you really want to watch something. And it's like, well, if it's not worth it for me to hang the TV up, it's not worth it for me to watch. But the point here is that whether it's making something obvious and easy, like flossing, or increasing the friction associated with it, like watching television, the principle of environment design is to put fewer steps between you and the good behaviors and more steps between you and the bad ones. Mm-hmm. And imagine if you did that in like 20 or 30 or 50 areas of your life, how much easier would it be to stick to good habits and avoid bad ones if the environment is continually priming you and nudging you toward the right option? Suddenly, willpower and grit and perseverance become something that's more of a natural extension of the environment than something that you need to call upon to overpower the environment that you're in. Interestingly, a lot of research has shown this, that the people who are best at resisting temptation, it's not actually that they are that much different from everybody else. It's actually that they see fewer temptations. They're like they're tempted less often. And so when they are, they have the reserves and the ability to avoid it. But it's more about the fact that they put themselves in good environments, and that is what leads to the appearance of increased willpower.
That is really interesting, actually, because it's not this idea that all these successful, you know, entrepreneurs or high performers are like that much better or that much smarter. It's just that they, you know, they're facing less temptations to begin with, right?
What they're smarter at is not overpowering the forces in their life. They're smarter at designing their life so they don't have the forces to begin with. Right. And you can do this in a lot of ways too. I've given some physical environment ways, but it works the same way for the digital environment. You know, like if you want to save money and stop spending money on like electronics, then don't subscribe to the latest like tech review blogs or things like that. You know, you're constantly being exposed to it there, and then you have to resist it over and over again. If you want to lose weight, don't follow a bunch of food bloggers on Instagram. You're continually being triggered and prompted to eat more. So think carefully about like where you're getting your, what your information diet is in your environment, both physical and digital. What are you seeing? What are you being exposed to? And try to make sure that the triggers and the prompts of your good habits are obvious and the cues of your bad habits are invisible.
Yeah. So James, I know we have to run, but last couple questions before we just sign off and wrap up here. Everybody, go pick up a copy of Atomic Habits: Tiny Changes, Remarkable Results. I mean, if you've gotten any value, I mean, there's a couple mindset shifts that we've even covered just in this conversation alone, and we'll obviously link to everything in the show notes as well as under this video. One of the things that you talked about was consistency, right? In, you know, having that ultimately kind of help you create the identity of, you know, in this case, becoming a writer. And I know a lot of people, when they're getting started, whether it's podcasting or creating videos or it doesn't matter, when it gets to that creative aspect of it, how did you go about building the right environment, just the right habit for you to even have the right outputs to consistently publish Mondays and Thursdays, for example?
So we've already talked about environment design a little bit. I think one additional thing to add, which is kind of on the back end of habits, is habit tracking and measurement. Okay. And you don't have to do this for every habit. I like to, broadly speaking, I bunch habits into two categories. So the first category are just like general life skills, things like flossing or tying your shoes or unplugging the toaster after you used it, stuff like that. You don't need a process of continuous improvement for habits like that, right? Like once you get them built, good enough is good enough. But then there's another category, which are things like, for me, it's things like weightlifting and writing and photography. There are probably two or three areas for most people where you do want to get continuously better and refine. And for those habits, it can be very useful to track them. And tracking does a few things. So the first thing is the most simplistic form of habit tracking is to use what's called a habit tracker, where you just like put an X on each calendar day that you do the habit. We're actually coming out with a habit journal that has some of these templates in it. That'll come out in January. But anyway, so habit tracking does three things. The first thing is that it makes your habits more obvious to you because it turns the action into a visual cue. So for example, each time you go to the gym and you put an X on the calendar, now you have this calendar that's reminding you whenever you look at it, hey, you go to the gym. So it creates a visual cue. The second thing is it has like an additive effect to motivation. So as you see the X's build up and your streak build up, you kind of get this one, you get this like momentum where you're like, oh man, I've been doing it 4 days in a row now. I need to go again. Yeah. And you also have this loss aversion thing where you're like, oh, I have a streak. I don't want to lose my streak. So I want to stick to it. So there's the motivation aspect. And then the third thing, and this is particularly important for getting habits to stick, which was your original question. It adds a little bit of immediate satisfaction to any habit. And this is the ending of habits, the immediate ending, the what happens right after you do it, is very important for getting them to stick. Because if you feel satisfied, if you feel successful in the moment, then it's kind of like a positive emotional signal to your brain. And it's like, hey, this felt good. You should do this again next time. But if you don't have that, if it's neutral, or if it feels punishing or just like sacrifice, you don't have much reason to continue it again. Mm-hmm. So this is particularly important for what I call habits of avoidance. So things like, I don't want to drink alcohol for 30 days, or I'm going to try to not eat out that often. We're going to try to cook meals instead,
right.
I'm going to try to not spend money on Amazon. Yeah. Habits like that are really challenging because you're just not doing something. You're just sitting, you have the temptation or the craving, and you're just saying, I'm just going to sit with it. So there's not really much satisfying about that experience. So to make that easier, you kind of need to invert that and find a way to feel satisfied in the moment. So one thing that I had a reader, he and his wife, they wanted to do the eating one. They wanted to cook more meals and not spend as much money eating out. So their habit was, let's not eat out. And again, that's hard to feel satisfied. So what they did was they opened up a little a savings account, and then they labeled it a trip to Europe. And then every time they didn't go out to eat, they would transfer $50 over to that account. And so it was like a way of making it feel satisfying in the moment. They're not going out to eat, but they do get to have the immediate satisfaction of seeing themselves save for the trip. And so figuring out some method like that to have immediate satisfaction is what helps you. It gives you a reason to repeat the habit again. And habit tracking is a very simple way of doing that. The other wonderful thing about habit tracking is that it reinforces the identity that you're building. So we've talked about identity multiple times, but if you say you go to the gym, you know, 15 times in a month, and you're trying to get in shape, and so you're real motivated, but then you hit a week where you're feeling like, oh, I just don't feel like going. And like, I'm not seeing any progress yet. The scale is basically the same. It's really easy in those moments to forget the work that you've put in the weeks prior. You don't really feel like you're succeeding. But if you have the habit tracker and you can look at it, you have visual proof that you can't deny that, hey, I went to the gym 15 times this month. And so it helps reinforce that identity even when you're not feeling up in the moment. So I think that can be an effective method for helping habits stick over the long run.
Yeah. I mean, it's so true that you have to almost get that immediate gratification one way or another. And I love that example of just saving, you know, being able to save money that way and being able to kind of see, you know, the actual results and, you know, have that trip to Europe, you know, be something that, you know, this couple was going for.
It's worth noting, because it ties in with the rest of the conversation that we had, is that the ultimate form of immediate gratification or immediate satisfaction with a habit is the reinforcement of your desired identity. Because if you feel like, you know, if you're trying to become the type of person who doesn't miss workouts, as soon as you go to the gym, you get the immediate satisfaction of being that person. Now, sometimes people find that hard to latch onto early on, which is why it can be useful to have additional reinforcements like saving money in the account or things like that. But once you've adopted that identity, it's a very powerful place because, you know, sometimes like I love working out now. It's a very big part of my life. And someone might look at that from the outside and say, oh, he's really good at delaying gratification. You know, like he'll go to the gym for months before he gets this result. But for me, it doesn't feel like that. What it feels like is I enjoy going to the gym, right? I reinforce my identity. I get to see some friends that are there. I get to move. So it's really when I'm thinking about it internally, I'm thinking much more about the immediate enjoyment that I get from it. When you look at it externally, it looks like I'm delaying gratification. And so I think in many areas of life, when people are really successful with a particular domain or area, they are good at finding alternative ways to be satisfied in the moment, rather than waiting for delayed gratification. And so because they have those alternative ways to be satisfied and get that immediate pleasurable signal, they have a reason to repeat it again in the future.
James, where can people follow you? And you know, they can obviously pick up the book, but I imagine for you, it's not Instagram and it's more jamesclear.com, right?
Yeah, well, you're welcome to follow me on Instagram if you'd like, but jamesclear.com is probably the best place to go if you want to see some articles and kind of poke around and see what interests you. I have things organized by different topics and categories. To find the book, atomichabits.com is the best place to go. And if you go there, the book is there, but we also have some additional downloads. So there are a few secret chapters that are not included in the actual finished book itself. There are some templates and exercises that help you build on some of the concepts that are in the book. And then there's also like a companion email guide that will walk you through some sections of the book with additional examples and strategies for getting started. So anyway, you can find all that stuff at atomichabits.com.
Awesome. And we're going to link to everything down below as well as in the show notes. James, last question. The name of the show, Inner Changemaker. For you, what comes to mind? Any images, any words? What comes to mind when you hear the word changemaker?
Well, personally, I usually think of entrepreneurs because that's both the path that I followed and most of the people who I know who are making really significant changes in the world are a creator or an entrepreneur of some sort. Even if they wouldn't identify as that, doesn't necessarily mean you have to have a business. But I also, you know, I resonate with the general philosophy of your show because I have a personal mantra that I have tried to operate my business around, which is mission over money, basically. Like I try to focus on the values and the identity that we're trying to build rather than optimizing for revenue. And I think that a lot of change makers start with some kind of vision or mission like that, where they say, this is the positive change I want to make in the world. Let me figure out how to make that viable or build a business around it or contribute it to society in some way. So I guess I'll say, values first or principles first, entrepreneurs.
Nice. Well, James, I want to take a few seconds and just acknowledge you for, you know, all the last few years, the writing and being that mission driven individual. It's part of the reason why I asked you to come on the show, even when I was just starting out years ago. And I'm really excited that we got a chance to do this collaboration. And I just really appreciate you, your work. And I know it's making a difference for many of your readers and many of our listeners as well. So
thank you so much. Yeah, I appreciate the opportunity. And I'm excited that that we had a chance to connect. So thank you again.
Awesome, man. We'll talk to you next time.
Want to discover how you can begin to tap into your inner changemaker and become the leader for the important people around you? You can now grab a copy of my new audio training, How to Be the Leader You Truly Are, for free at www.theinnerchangemaker.com/leadership. Inside the training, you will find my top 3 proven strategies from millionaires and billionaires that have been featured on the show. And by simply applying them, I was able to go from sleeping in my parents' living room to leading and running multiple successful businesses and began an endless journey of impacting those closest to me. You can do it too. Go to www.theinnerchangemaker.com/leadership to get your free copy now.